Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm George Chen, and you're listening to Sup Doc, a show where we talk to our interesting friends from the entertainment world, sharing about their favorite documentaries. Today, we're covering Todd Haynes' Velvet Underground documentary, released in 2021 on Apple TV. Haynes talks to the surviving members of the band and a lot of the New York art world and the Warhol factory scene about this legendary group that blended drone multimedia and doo-wop. And our guest is music publicist and Velvets fan, Daniel Gill, who runs Fourfield PR and is joining us on a rainy day in Los Angeles. Hi, and welcome to Sup Doc, Dan.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, you reached out to me about this one, which is great, because like I was meaning to see this. We kind of like, it came out in October on streaming, yeah. So we've had a little time to process and digest this one.
I think the main reason I reached out is because you hadn't covered it yet, and I felt like it was it was one of the best music documentaries of the year, at least a three-way tie with probably Summer of Soul and the Sparks Brothers, I think.
Yeah, Sparks Brothers I really enjoyed well. And I feel like this came out very close to – it came out before Get Back, but I feel like there's a lot of – maybe – I don't know if it's similar – I wouldn't say it's similar at all to Get Back, but just like two bands that like everyone kind of lionizes. But then I realize at a certain point, I'm like, do I actually know that much about these people? Maybe I don't.
Yeah, there were things I learned, you know, even I'm not like a super nerdy Velvet Underground fan or Lou Reed fan, but I definitely know all the records and know most of the, you know, lore. But and I've also. So I should also mention sort of like full disclosure moment. I did publicity. I was on the PR team for the Nico 1988 film. Right. And I put together a tribute show to Nico in New York City. That was pretty fun. I have some stories about that, but we probably won't even get into that. But also I worked on the I worked PR on the Danny Fields documentary called Danny Says. I don't know if have you seen that?
No, but I looked him up right after watching this, and then I saw that there was a film, and it was on Magnolia released it, and it came out, what, 3 years ago, four years ago?
Yeah, about 3 years ago. It's really good.
Yeah, it looks amazing, because he worked with, I remembered his name from writing that book about the Doors, and I didn't realize he had all these other connections to, like, Jonathan Richman and the Stooges and MC5 and all that stuff. But yeah, Danny Fields, he definitely stands out as a character in this. There's a lot of interviews. Most of this is like, it's like 80% like archival footage. And then like a few like interviews that are beautifully shot with a lot of these New York art people. Did you live in New York?
New York for about 3 years in the early 2000s, right when like, it was like the Strokes, Interpol, Yeah's, TV on the radio, and LCD Sound System were all just starting. So that was fun. It was fun to be there for that moment. It was basically meet me in the bathroom moment.
Yeah, right. I remember some of that stuff. Did you work PR in the other music doc?
Yes, I did that one too.
Which we talked to Rob and Paloma. There was a really good interview as well. Yeah, so you've worked on a lot of film documentaries. I've actually noticed like more of it. You also worked on the Shane McGowan doc, which we didn't really get to like talk about in the show.
Yeah.
But I think you just shared on Facebook or Instagram or something that he finally did an interview. Like he hadn't done any interviews during the Julian Temple film coming out. Yeah.
He didn't do any interviews at all while we were doing press on the film, but now he has a coffee table art book out that's like retails for like $1,000 or something. And so he, and so he finally did one interview, and it was with the New York Times, of course. That's the only thing that he would get off his couch for.
I mean, it was the saga of the last 20 years, just checking in on Shane's teeth.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, he's got no teeth. He had,
did you watch did you watch Croc of Gold?
I watched Croc of Gold, yeah.
Okay, yeah,
yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, it was great, yeah.
I also really did the Zappa film also that you did an episode on.
Yeah, you did PR on that film. So that's interesting because the Zappa makes a brief mention in this film as like they were the hippies. Like we hated them.
Oh, yeah, we hated them. And they snuck on, they snuck on a bill opening for, or I don't know,
it was a Warhol, it was an exploding plastic
show or like, something.
Yeah,
I think it was that tour when that tour hit the West Coast. Thus, I love the story about Bill Graham. That's in the film.
Watching this, I was watching this. I'm like, some people didn't make any money doing this, and then there was Bill Graham, and
but he apparently he had some kind of beef with the Velvet Underground, or I guess he was not a fan, but he had booked the show in San Francisco, and they were about to go on stage, and he said, "I hope you fuckers bomb," or something like that.
Yeah, which is funny because I never think of like the Velvet Underground as like bombing or killing or like using like those term, and that terminology doesn't seem to apply to that band.
It doesn't
like,
apply.
Okay. So yeah, like I knew a bit about the Velvets, more like just being in, you know, a music fan, and I'd seen the Tony Conrad documentary, which I felt like there was bits of this that really overlapped with
I really
Tony
need
Conrad
to see that. I haven't even watched that.
Oh, that's great. That's made by a guy, Tyler Hubby, who is an Echo Park local. Yeah.
Yeah. I really need to see that.
Yeah. Cause like that's the world, like the first, I'd say it feels like maybe 45 minutes of the film is like just setting up. We're going in deep into this. So if you don't know the Velvet Underground at all, let's back up just like a hair.
Oh, yeah. Well, back. All right. I want to back way up. Actually, I want to back way up.
Let's way back up. Yeah.
First of all, Todd Haynes.
Okay.
So I read that Laurie Anderson actually approached him and said, "You're number one on our list to make a document, the official Velvet Underground documentary. Do you want to do it?" And he said yes immediately. So they never got to the any other people that were on her list. But apparently that was a Laurie Anderson decision.
Oh, that was one question I was thinking is like, she only appears as like a still photo.
Yeah.
Because I guess her relationship with Lou is long
later,
after the band's over.
Yeah.
But like, so as like the basically widow, does she have?
Well,
like,
she, I mean, yeah, I guess she has control of the estate at this point.
The estate. Okay. Right. That makes
sense. So Todd Haynes, my first exposure to Todd Haynes was when he, in the early 90s, you probably remember since we're about the same age, there was a sort of like underground circuit of people tape trading, like VHS tapes.
Yeah.
And one of the tapes that I got my hands on was, had the Superstar Karen Carpenter story. Have you seen that?
Yes, and I saw it again. Like, yeah, like someone lending me a VHS tape.
So that was
that
like,
long ago. Yeah.
Banned. I mean, the urban legend was this has been banned. You know, this is like illegal to even own it because of the the Carpenters had sued him or whatever. Anyway, and which I think is actually true.
I believe that's true. That's on Wikipedia.
Although,
yeah.
The film itself is on YouTube, which we should put a link to it in the show notes for this episode because it is an important piece, I think, of Todd Haynes' backstory. And you can only watch it on YouTube. But anyway, so I saw the. So if you don't know about this film, it's about a 40-minute sort of short film that Todd Haynes made when he was still in film school, I believe, as a. Anyway. Maybe in his master's thesis project or something, but he made this film that is sort of a biopic of Karen Carpenter and her anorexia, and he did it using Barbie dolls. And as the character is getting skinnier and skinnier, he's literally shaving plastic off the dolls to make them appear skinnier. The Karen Carpenter character. It's very unnerving. It's very unsettling to watch. It was really messed up. But anyway, I got my hands on a VHS copy of that around, like, I don't know, 1996 or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was my first exposure to Todd Haynes. And I don't think I even really put two and two together at that time about who he was or his importance. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I found out later, oh, he's the guy who did the Disappear video for Sonic Youth. And then he made, you know, apparently, I also read that Sonic Youth approached him to do the music video because they were fans of the Karen Carpenter Barbie doll movie. And so there's this whole, and so it makes sense. And then he also did.
Is that the Sonic Youth video that, like, is kind of like a Karen Carpenter? Or no, like, there's a Karen Carpenter cover? Or the Carpenter's cover?
No, they covered the song Superstar.
They covered Superstar.
That was on a tribute to the Carpenters that was later on.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Okay, yeah, I remember
that. Was
the cover.
After Goo came out, I'm pretty sure.
Right after Goo.
So he did a video for that was off Goo. I think he may have done another song of theirs too. But anyway, so he had the Sonic Youth connection. Then he made Velvet Goldmine.
Right.
Which also has a character who is loosely based on Lou Reed and Iggy Pop as sort of one character that's played by Ewan McGregor.
Right.
And he
right.
insinuates that there was like a love triangle thing with like the David Bowie character and then this character, but that never actually really happened, apparently.
Oh, okay. So that was.
But apparently, I think it was a reference to David Bowie having a fling with Mick Jagger, which did really happen. But he was sort of, you know, he kind of was able to play loosey goosey with it because. These were, you know, fake characters that were
right
loosely based on real people, but weren't named after them in the movie.
Right, right. So not straight biopic. I remember like hearing that was like more referential.
Yeah.
My exposure. That's basically my exposure to Todd Haynes was primarily Superstar, and like he basically made like every Julianne Moore movie in the 90s. Kind of broke her career, actually, it seems like.
Right.
And yeah, so this is his first documentary.
First documentary.
Not being super familiar with his style, I sort of think of his style as almost being like melodrama.
Yeah.
Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's pretty fair. I mean, he made a lot of movies that would fall in that category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seemed like on the last few films he made, I hadn't seen them, but like Carol sounds like very melodrama.
Yeah.
The Douglas Sirk sort of reference that I was reading about. That. So it's interesting that this is his first film. So it sounds like he actually got pitched it by Laurie Anderson, which is news to me. Yeah, that makes some sense. And so basically the outline, I think from before watching this film, I assume everyone, if you don't know the Velvet Underground at a very basic level, in the 60s is like a band that came together with Lou Reed and John Cale, hilariously coming out of another kind of novelty song, which we'll talk about in a second.
Yeah.
But and then I knew about, I'm going to get deeper into the weeds here. Angus MacLise, I thought, was a big part of the story originally, and stuff I read on Wikipedia mentions Angus MacLise as a first drummer.
He's barely mentioned in the movie.
Yeah, barely. Yeah, he's mentioned as like another roommate at their Ludlow Street place, like living with Jack Smith and Tony Conrad and John Cale. Also, like, who does the chores at that house? It's like the young I picture like the young ones of avant-garde music, like a bunch of like rando like John Cale, Tony Conrad, Henry Flint, like all living in a building together.
Now that's the perfect way to describe it, and I hadn't
the
even
young ones.
Yes, I hadn't even thought of that, but that's perfect. Yeah, let's call it ones apartment.
Yeah. And then the thing that most people wouldn't know about this band would be the Andy Warhol connection.
Yeah.
The very famous Banana Peel album cover, Velvet Underground and Nico. And then the things people say about a lot of lore about Velvet Underground that didn't get mentioned at all, like the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, supposedly named after the Velvet Underground, like Václav Havel was a huge fan of the band. And there's like sort of like this weird in Czech Republic, there was like these bands that were all like, you know, politically active and sort of like referenced Velvet Underground. And let's
remind
see.
Remind me, I do want to talk a little bit about the politics of the Velvet Underground, but later
oh,
on.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. On. Yes. Because yeah. those take a strange turn.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
like are not really referenced too much in this.
No.
In this film whatsoever.
No, they left out a lot of stuff that could have been. But also knowing that they had to get basically, I mean, you know, kind of knowing how involved Laurie was in.
Sure.
The movie, I know why a lot of this stuff was left out, but
yeah,
we'll get to that later. But anyway, yeah. So I guess the main other thing to know about the Velvet Underground is that there's this quote that I don't think was in the film, but like right. you know, no one really bought the records and nobody really went to their concerts, but the 10 people who did all started bands.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
all started record labels, or they all did something with their lives in music. So basically it was affected the people who did hear it at the time in a profound way.
Yeah, I've heard that quote as well, and I don't know who that was originally attributed to, but it's become almost like just like a conventional wisdom yeah. sort of thing people right. have said about that band. So it's sort of like, you know, the cult's band's cult band.
The cult band's cult time. Band, yeah.
yeah.
So yeah, and then I think that the movie does he set up one very strict rule mm-hmm. Todd Haynes did when he approached this movie, which was only the only people I'm talking to for this film are people who were there. Mm-hmm. Who were there mm-hmm. on the scene involved in some way, first person.
Right, which is why it doesn't have the thing that like a lot of music talks of the last several years have had the same talking heads in them
yeah.
over and over
again. They didn't
again.
Go yeah. and interview Dave Grohl. Or,
yeah, yeah, you know, exactly.
Thank God. I actually really appreciated that aspect of the film in a big way, because actually mm-hmm. the film he ended up making because of that rule was a lot artier and a lot more like of a combined Andy Warhol / Velvet Underground documentary than mm-hmm. what it's not. I mean, so actually I watched the Sparks Brothers a little bit after I watched the Velvet Underground, and I was like, man, they don't really, I mean, it was a great story, but they had so many talking heads. It was like, I don't really need to know like what Patton Oswalt thinks about Sparks.
Right. Right. That was a big critique I'd heard of that.
Don't get me
film.
Wrong. I like Patton.
No.
He's
nothing
funny.
Against him.
Nothing just against like, Patton. I'm just yeah. using him as an example, but it's like, you know, there were so many talking heads. It was just overwhelming. And then go ahead.
Oh no. Like I was thinking too, like that was Edgar Wright's first documentary as well.
Yes.
But that really like, it played with the form a little bit in terms of like there was a lot of like animation and a lot of different stuff like that. But then it really like fell victim to some of these tropes that I think keep happening. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Velvet Underground doc starts with this crazy clip of John Cale yes. on a talk show or a game show called I've Got a Secret. And the secret that he supposedly they don't really show the guessing game that the contestants yeah. have to do, but apparently the contestants were having to guess what his secret was. And the secret was that he had just performed an 18-hour concert of Eric Satie music. Other guest or the other guy who was next to him, his secret was that he was the only person in the audience to make it through the whole 18-hour performance and yeah. without leaving. So, and this was a U.S. CBS like network television event that I couldn't believe. I mean, I think the absurdity of it is the reason Todd Haynes opens with it, because the fact that this was on CBS in whatever year it was is insane.
Right. Yeah.
And, there is an absurdity, I think, and like comedy to some of the John Cage, or like early the new music avant-garde, where it would be like instructions to destroy your piano with an axe, which also gets referenced, which I think was a John Cage thing. Anyway, so they're sort of setting it up so that John Cale is the avant-garde element
yeah.
of the Velvet Underground, which is definitely a overriding theme John Cale brought the noise, the drone, the, he was the one who was hanging out with Tony Conrad and Lamont Young and like,
yeah,
you know, like studying all this stuff and brought that side of it to the band. And I think it actually is also the reason he was kicked out of the band.
Because he was like, he was technically the most accomplished also, yeah, right? He was, yeah, classically trained in viola.
Yeah.
He said he was like trying to do these Paganini pieces,
yeah,
and stuff when he was, when he was a kid. So yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's definitely how it's set up. It's sort of set up as like Lou Reed is like kind of working class, like New York guy, like Long, yeah, Island maybe. Yeah. And then like Cale is Welsh and they make such a big deal of him being Welsh. She's like,
yes,
oh, he's so Welsh. He's so worldly. You
know? Yeah.
Like what I always think of the Welsh, very worldly, but, no, it's
so they,
pretty,
they
it's,
do. He does take a long time. The whole, I mean, the first, like, I don't know, 45 minutes of the film is a lot of setup of like this, like,
yeah,
art world, avant-garde noise scene kind of like, I mean, I actually, I don't think any mainstream piece of art has spent so much time on like Tony Conrad and Lamont Young and like these characters.
Yeah. Right? I actually like, that's why I feel like the overlap with the Tony Conrad film is like pretty interesting. It's like, yeah, like Apple TV is paying, like,
right, you Apple, know, TV, Apple TV is paying
for us to learn about like the deep, like New York,
yeah,
like people that were like super, super deep in the underground.
Yeah. That was like one of the crazier things. But also I feel like he wouldn't have had time to do that in a 2-hour doc if he had done the, you know, talking head route.
Right, right.
So that's, I, true, appreciated that. And it was also, yeah, I mean, think about how many kids watched this film and were exposed to all these crazy people that otherwise they would have no idea about anyway.
And I like that's not like Todd Haynes's generation either at all.
Right,
like that's not his generation or his experience. He's like, right, very, he's a bit younger, on the younger side of this. Like I was just watching, I was trying to explain, cause I watched this with my wife and was like trying to remind her who Jonathan Richman was.
Yeah.
Cause he's also makes a great appearance in here. And I've known for a long time that he was super obsessed with the Velvets. He's probably seen them the most out of anyone that wasn't in the Velvet Underground.
Yeah, I was wondering if he like followed them around like the Dead or something, because he said he saw them 60 or 70 times. He must have been following them around.
Or like being, or just, in Boston and being able to go to New York and probably see, yeah, them if they played in like Providence or played in Connecticut or something.
Yeah. But they also would do these residencies.
Right.
You know, where they would play every single night for a month. And so he must have just been around. Maybe he would just go to New York and camp out with a friend and go every night.
I could definitely picture that.
The Polish home shows.
Oh yeah.
You know, Dom, that was right. Dom. Yeah. I actually lived when I lived in New York, I lived on the Lower East Side and I lived near there.
Mm.
And I went to a couple events there that were pretty fun.
Did you ever go to Lamont Young and Marianne Zazila's like dream house thing? You can,
no,
just go,
I
and
never,
it's like an apartment where it's just like a drone happening, yeah, all day long. And like, Marianne,
I think I
like,
found out about it too late. I found out like, yeah, I found out about it literally like right after I moved away and I was like, oh damn it.
Yeah.
Or they stopped doing it right around that,
yeah,
time.
Yeah. I think they took a break from doing it.
Yeah.
The last time I was in New York was like in 2017. I was just like, oh man, we should have just gone then if they were doing it then. But it seemed to like to take little breaks here and there. Yeah.
It also seemed like a very big time commitment. Like if you went there, you would probably need to stay for, I don't know, at least over an hour or more.
Yeah. I love that they reference like using the refrigerator hum as the tuning.
That's
like,
a tuning tone. Fork.
There was a tuning, yeah, fork. Yeah. That stuff. Yeah. I love all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So it takes a really long time to kind of set up the, I think, okay, so here's the other, so I have heard some complaints about this film.
Okay.
And I guess some of them are that they spend too much time building up the gestation of the band and basically it's a long-winded explanation of how the Velvet Underground and Nico album came together, and then the subsequent albums only get about 5 minutes.
I agree with that. Like, there's sort of like, it sort of blows by a lot of this stuff. Like I said, there was like, you know, chunks obviously, like, I'm saying, like, this thing, like, Angus MacLeese, like,
yeah,
I read, like, he actually even rejoined the band for one of these residencies, like, in Chicago. Yeah. Like, Lou was out, and then, like, they moved to him playing drums, Mo doing bass, and then John as a lead singer for, like, this Chicago residency they did. Yeah. And that was, like, in 66 or something. So, like, he came back in the fold even. Gets nary a mention.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that is true. And, like, even a lot of stuff that, like, I wanted to dig in a little more, maybe it's all the post band stuff. Like, they just kind of show, like, oh, John and Lou got back together for this Songs for Drella record.
Right.
Oh, like, you know, that they don't really explain.
Right.
I mean, I remember this thing where they got the core four people back together in the, was it in like early 2000s that they did that?
Yeah.
Yeah. To play, I don't know what it was, like a tribute, or was it like some Andy tribute or something like that? I think it
was
like,
well, I think the Drella album was a tribute to Andy Warhol.
Right. That might have been like 89 or 90. I think
there was a proper show that was turned into a live album.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was later. That was like a proper Velvet Underground reunion.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, none of that stuff really gets any time in the film. They kind of just, they set up, they basically introduce the band one by one. John Cale really gets the most screen time. Well, not only because he's still alive and they was able to be interviewed at length. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of footage of him, and he has probably one of the more interesting backstory. And then he was only on the first two records.
Right.
And then, so I think part of it was also setting it up that for that drama of him getting kicked out of the band. And anyway, so we should back up for 1 second there. Should we play a clip?
So I did want to, like we kind of mentioned this. This is hilarious to me. And a part of the story I did not know. What's this group that gets put together? It's Tony Conrad, John Cale, Lou Reed. I think the other guy was maybe Lou's like college buddy.
Yeah.
And then they get put together with Lou to buy this record company called Pickwick.
Which Lou Reed was working there as their in-house songwriter. It was kind of like K-Tel Records, like where they would just re-record hit songs of the moment and put them out as these compilation albums and sell them for 99 cents at the drugstore or whatever.
Yeah.
It was kind of like the 50s or 60s version of Spotify playlists.
like the ones that are just AI generated. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like vibe, or the mood generated. Or is actually what it was is the Now That's What I Call Music series. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Just like very budget produced hits. But Lou was like, also the fact that Lou was like an in-house, like kind of like, you know,
low budget
grill building pop songwriter makes very little sense based on what we know of him now. But they put together, they just jammed and came up with kind of a novelty song called The Ostrich, which has an accompanying dance.
They were playing under the name The Primitives, not to be confused with the other band, The UK Primitives, who were like in the 80s in the UK. Actually, I noticed those songs are on Spotify and in YouTube and stuff. So, look up The Primitives, The Ostrich.
And here's we'll a little clip in. Of them. Yeah, here's them talking about it and a clip of The Primitives.
He had a vision. He was talented beyond his talent, if you understand what I mean. He can't sing, he can't play. But everything he does in that craggly voice of his resonated with me. With Lou, we were going to blaze a trail, which eventually he did.
Tony got an invitation to a party. We went up there, and this guy comes up to us and said, "Hey, you guys look very commercial. Would you like to come and promote a record?" Now, come out to Long Island City, and it was Pickwick Records, and their songwriter at the time was Lou Reed. When I met Lou, there was a lot of eyeballing going on. So we had coffee, and and my viola. And I still playing sort of classical viola with this heavy vibrato and really sound like really classical and good and all of that. And Lou said, shit, I knew you had an edge in it.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I want to say one more thing about the ostrich. The importance of that moment in history is that that was the first time that John Cale and Lou Reed played together and met each other. They met each other because somebody had recruited this band that John Cale and Tony Conrad had that right. to come. They said, you guys look like rock and rollers or something. And like, yeah. You want to come up to Pickwick Records. And then they met Lou Reed there at Pickwick. Uh-huh. And then basically they recorded two songs, The Ostrich and then the B-side. And then they, started playing together. And then I guess as that happened, Lou kind of like casually mentioned to John Cale, hey, I've got these other songs that I've been working on that are like too weird for Pickwick Records. What do you think about these? And he showed him like Heroin and Venus and Furs, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
John Cale was like, oh my God. Okay. So that's like the birth of the Velvet Underground in that moment.
Yeah. And I love that also, like, what did John Cale said? He said, you know, these lyrics are really put together and very dark, and the music's not as dark as the lyrics are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that led to bringing, I think of like the core of the band seems to be at the beginning is like the dynamic of those two, right? It was sort of like the avant-garde minimalism and the kind of like love of like kind of old-timey rock and roll. That's at least that's like kind of like how they frame it. I'm sure like, you know, Lou was pretty hip to other stuff that was going on. I mean, he made Metal Machine music eventually.
Yeah.
So that's the part that I'm like, I think it's sort of maybe an undersell to like say, like John was all, but also like you said, John's alive. I think I'm thankful there's more John Cale than there is Maureen Tucker in this film. Just guessing, based on, things I've read about Maureen Tucker in the last few years.
Right.
But, Lou is like a huge piece of this that is like sort of absent, but, I mean, I just realized like how much stuff happens after the Velvet Underground breaks up. They just show, he's like, oh, at the end, they're like, this guy put out 22 albums and like studio albums.
So here's a part of the thing. I think that each of them individually probably deserve their own documentary.
Totally. Totally.
You know,
it is an Avengers problem, essentially.
It is a Marvel universe. It's the Velvet Underground cinematic universe that we're in now.
Oh, I mean, look, actually, the Tony Conrad is like the Sony Spider-Man movies.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually, if you think about it, Nico already has two films about her. She has a documentary, Nico Icon, which is great. And then Nico 1988, a biopic. So she kind of got two movies before the Velvet Underground even got their one proper movie.
I would argue, I was having trouble Googling this. I saw this film. It's kind of a third film that is kind of like a Velvet Goldmine-ish version. Like, it's like not called Nico, but it's a character that's based on Nico. And I saw it like 12 years ago, and it's in another language. I'm really having trouble nailing it down. I'm really going to start Googling and trying to figure out what this film was, because I remember seeing it, and like people were like, oh, this is basically about her. She's like a rock star heroin addict, and like, yeah, like that's, but it's like, it's French or German or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I know what you're talking about. I forgot the name of it also.
That one too. Yeah. Yeah.
So actually it is kind of strange that it took this long for there to be a Velvet Underground documentary. Mm-hmm. But I mean, obviously Lou deserves his, if there was more footage of him talking and being interviewed, I think they would probably have maybe included some of that, or maybe he would be getting his own Todd Haynes documentary to follow up this one. I don't know. I don't know how long Todd Haynes really wants to hang on this one topic, but
he's probably done with it. Yeah. I've heard, and you know more music writers than I do probably at this point, like that he was a very notoriously prickly interview. Have you heard this before?
Lou Reed, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like sort
of. Well, maybe this is a good time to talk about that. Lou Reed was definitely a prickly personality in general.
Yeah.
And I think they get into that a little bit in the film, but they don't really talk about like the fact that he was also abusive to some of his partners.
Oh.
And he also had this sort of like, a couple of times, there's some theories about him being a racist, but that impartially I don't know. There's a couple of reasons why he may have been, that may have been accurate.
Interesting.
And then also there was also some kind of misogyny with, you know, him not wanting, John Cale definitely did not want Mo Tucker to be their drummer because she was a chick drummer.
Oh,
there was
John,
that side of it.
Oh, that did not John get Cale. Mentioned. Yeah. Wow.
That does not get mentioned. That's true, though. He was like resistant to it, and they kind of lied to him and said, oh, don't worry, it'll just be like temporary. You have to just like deal with it for like a little bit, and then we'll replace her.
Do you think it was maybe because he was homies with Angus MacLeese, though? That could have been maybe,
the reason he gave was that
she was
a female drummer.
Oh, man.
And then there's also, you know, Nico was like a Nazi sympathizer. Did you know that?
I feel like I would have remembered that. But then again, I did also just watch the Von Dutch documentary and completely forgotten that was part of that story too. That there was like a Nazi sympathy. Well, she's German. Like what? I don't know the backstory with that. I just remember like, yeah, she would have been a child during
I didn't realize this
World War II, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't really realize this, but then I had agreed already to work on the Nico 1988 film, and I didn't know this about her backstory, and then people started emailing me.
Oh no.
Hey, have you ever like Googled like Nico and Nazi sympathizer? Because you probably should.
Oh my lord. Well, I mean, the fact that Laurie Anderson is like a co-producer on this, I understand like why that doesn't get mentioned at all. Lou stuff.
And then the Lou stuff is all a little vague, but there's definitely some stuff about him abusing partners, and I can't remember which partners, but more than one.
Yeah, his girlfriend from like his like college era girlfriend, she's interviewed early on in this, like in the first 10, 15 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
And his sister is mentioned. They talk a little bit about like the like shock treatment that he got, which is like all like, right. you know, like gay panic stuff or like, yes. you know, yeah, it's like homophobic.
Right. Yes. He was definitely bisexual.
Yeah.
For
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. yeah.
Right. But they, yeah, I guess like, at the time it was like, oh, we're going to do this shock electroshock therapy to try to rid you of your homosexual tendencies. Mm-hmm. That's very, disturbing. Yeah. But anyway, so there's a lot of parts of the Velvet Underground where you kind of have to like, if you have to separate the art from the artist, which I know is very difficult for like, this current, you know, era we're in, but it's like, yeah, if you really want to maintain your fandom of Velvet Underground, there's four different people involved that have, oh, and then we didn't even talk about Mo Tucker and her
tea and, party. She became like a tea party person. I remember.
Yeah. She was definitely a vocal advocate of the tea party and, which sort of kind of led into Trumpism. I don't know if she, went full MAGA or voted for Trump. I don't know, but she was definitely not a fan of Obama. I mean, you know, I don't, she doesn't claim that. I think I read it. I just reread an interview that she did where she said, I'm not really a full Republican. I only really am going along with this Tea Party stuff, which I mean, it's almost worse, right?
Yeah, so. Like it's just the racism part. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So,
Well, there's a line. It's funny. There is a line that I was kind of like laughing at. Then just I remembered, like, oh yeah, this fully may be part of her political view when they're talking about going to California and like, mm-hmm. you know, peace and love and all that bull crap. And I'm like, oh yeah, yeah. That makes sense now because this is like. This is maybe like the rhetoric of like Mo Tucker now as well. Yeah. Maybe at the time, or like there's sort of like this sort of okay. There's something that's brought up that is brought up early on. I think it's by Kale, and it's an interesting. I've thought about this with punk as well, and they're kind of proto-punk in a lot of ways. He's like, yeah. It's good to have something you're defining yourself against, right? Because yeah. then you have not only you have. A definition for yourself and you have something to challenge or like to strive against, I guess. I think that sort of makes sense, but like that's sort of like negation, right? And like that's a very right. core punk thing as well. And I can sort of see like some of their world sort of fitting into that. Like the so I think I'd break this into like a third, the middle third really kicks off with Andy Warhol and Factory.
Yes.
Because they're a band that's been doing stuff.
Yes.
It's just they get introduced to this scene. So
there's a key pivotal moment that I had mentioned in my notes that is basically when this woman, Barbara Rubin, is that her name?
Yeah, Barbara Rubin, yeah.
Okay, she goes to see the band when they have their first residency in New York at Cafe Bizarre. And she is already an active participant in the Factory, tight friends with Warhol, tight friends with Dylan, and a filmmaker of her own. And then she goes to see them. She really likes it. And she goes back to the Factory and she basically makes a big announcement. Hey guys, there's this amazing band playing downtown. We all need to go see them. They're called the Velvet Underground. So that was kind of like, you know, if you think about it in today's terms, you know, obviously in those days, pre-internet, and mm-hmm. there was the gatekeeper
yeah.
mentality was, are they cool enough to be considered cool by the Factory and Andy Warhol, right? So, like, they were kind of like Andy Warhol was kind of like the Illuminati of the day. Like, what he had considered cool was cool. Automatically.
I was just saying that because this is the second time I've watched this. I've sort of forgotten the scene where it's like, you know, like model-esque women coming down to the Factory to be looked at, to be seen.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, this is like, it's such like influencer culture. This was like, he's the first guy, right? His 15 minutes of fame, everyone off 15 minutes of fame. All that stuff kind of came true. Yeah, that's a that is a good point. I was going to say, as a publicist, now if you look at this, this idea of like breaking a band in like 1967, like it's got to be completely different because like, you know, like there's it's going to be like Rolling Stone or something is like your main thing you have to do. Were you thinking at all about like kind of like your work and your world at all while watching this?
It reminded me of some kind of, you know, the time I didn't spend a lot of time in New York, but the 3 years I was there, there seems to be this kind of like a gatekeeper mentality, especially in New York City, where it's kind of like a band or a new solo act or whatever doesn't really take off until certain people in the upper echelon gatekeeper world are down. You know what I'm saying? LCD Sound System would maybe be a good example of like watching their ascent. You don't really see them going crazy until like the owners at Bowery Presents start booking them all the time and booking them at like, they have this thing called Siren Fest that the Billy would put on with the Village Voice, and they would, you know, give them the headlining slot or the slot right before the bigger artist or whatever. And like, especially in the live music world and at press, those two kind of go hand in hand, where there's a lot of people who make the big decisions, like who's going to go on the cover of Rolling Stone or Spin, and who's going to go on the best slot at the music festival. A lot of those people are friends with each other and kind of like reading each other's notes. So if an artist makes it to that crowd, it's kind of like that Barbara Rubin moment that I just talked about is kind of like the moment where they were put on. You know, she put them on.
Yeah.
It's what the kids would say now. Who put you on, you know?
Right.
Like Barbara Rubin put them on to Andy Warhol and to all the factory people. And so then it became a whole thing where all the famous people would go into their shows and Andy became interested. And, you know, that without that happening, they probably break up and we never hear of them.
Right.
Without that one moment.
Yeah, that's like, that is such a pivotal moment in the story, and they seem to all know that as well. It's not like oversold. It's like this is why there is this documentary now, essentially. Like this moment, and like as close as people like, you know, like Tony Conrad's not like a household name the way Andy Warhol is, you know.
Right,
so that's like, that just would have been a different thing altogether.
So so we have Andy Warhol enters the scene, and then one of the things that he does at the urging of, I believe it was Paul Morrissey, well, Nico had been hanging around the factory for a little bit, and so Paul Morrissey said, hey Andy, we should really get Nico to sing with the Velvet Underground because none of them are very good looking and we're not going to be able to sell this band or get them signed or get them on tour unless they have like an attractive member. So then Andy Warhol goes to Lou and basically has to beg him on hand and knee to like let Nico sing with them. And then they talk about Nico like not really fitting in, and they took a while to figure out how to use her voice best with their style of music. And then John Cale kind of figured out to like have her sing in the lower register, like the more drony style singing that she ended up being her trademark. So anyway, that's a pretty interesting chapter of the film.
I did not know that she already had like a single out, like in Germany also.
Right.
So she wasn't like a complete like beginner to
She had already been in big movies too.
Right.
Like, and she'd already done two or three films.
And she was friends with Jim Morrison, I was reading as well. So, She
definitely wasn't a nobody at that time.
Yeah, it still took a lot of convincing for Lou. I think for Lou, I just get the sense, and they do kind of say, like, he's kind of a control freak. He's kind of like, you know, a micromanaging person.
Yeah.
I mean, it sort of comes across that's the case. Yeah.
Also, he wanted to be the rock star. He was They say it very clearly. Like, mm-hmm. his goal in life was, I'm going to be a rock star.
Yeah.
I don't care how I get to that point. I'm going to be the star.
And he pulled it off. you know, for someone to pull that off, like, to the level that he did, where you could still put out Metal Machine music and then still put out albums after that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's no comparison. There's no one else had a career like Lou Reed. There's no one else in rock history that you could even compare him to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a singular career. There's no one else. I mean, not even Bowie or Eno or anyone. Like, I don't think it even compares.
Oh, you know what is also interesting about this film is a lot of the Warhol footage. The way everyone's introduced is essentially Warhol would do these really long take, like film portraits of people. So, like, you start with this, like, pretty, I've seen this before, this Lou Reed, like, still photo. Or it's not, it feels like a still photo, but you can see him blinking.
Before I had gone to the factory, I had seen Warhol's Kiss. There were no titles. I had no idea who had made it. And it was a weekly serial, so that every week, a 2 3/4 minute roll shown at proper speed, which was 16 frames a second. The thing that's always interesting about the Warhol silence is the reason they're unreal is they're supposed to be shown at 16 frames a second, which means that the people in those images are breathing and their hearts are beating in a different time frame than yours is while you watch it. And that creates an incredible sense of aesthetic distance.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
There was an interesting moment where they talk about the extended time of the Warhols of the this is one of my clips. So they kind of talk about the concept of extended time where Warhol would film things like the Kiss, which was basically just these slow motion, long, drawn out images of two people kissing, and they took it and slowed it down. And basically that was kind of the film version of drone, which obviously corresponded with what John Cale was bringing to,
the
band.
Yeah, the viola is notably absent on the Unloaded, right? There's like no viola on there, I don't think. Yeah,
right. I mean,
it's a Doug Yule record. Yeah,
yeah. And the other, I guess also no mentioning Doug Yule. He's the only person who was approached to be a part of the film and declined.
So all his interviews are basically archival from other stuff. Yeah, yeah. That's interesting.
It is weird that he was given the opportunity to be part of this and didn't want to.
Yeah, that is strange. It's stylistically, because there's like very little, I think we'd say in terms of what we're used to with, you know, a band from the 70s or 80s, you probably have a good amount of live footage. There's live footage of the Velvet Underground, but a lot of it is, on film. And there's not that much of it. So I think that led to Todd Haynes choosing to do things slightly differently. Like, I think like you were saying, this is, it's good in a sense that like the only Talking Head interviews are people that were actually in the scene, like Mary Warrenoff, or you've got, you know, like, you know, Sterling's wife, or, you know, Lou Reed's sister. So people that could give you that character. Jonas Mekas, who I guess passed away in 2019.
He's interesting in the film.
I watched a little short thing about him. You know, I had not seen his films. I've heard his name in reference a lot in terms of art stuff, but I didn't know much about him. They're sort of like, once they're in, it's sort of like once they are in the Warhol sphere, you're right, they kind of have ascended to at least people know who they are, even though they said stuff like they got signed in a way to like just keep them off the street, which I loved as a line.
My favorite part of that was how they said they probably wouldn't have even signed us unless without knowing that Andy Warhol would do our album cover art.
Right. Yeah.
And that Nico would be in the press photos.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that was maybe a Mo Tucker quote. It was a good one. So, you know, they got signed to Verve, and they don't actually, one thing I was a little bit, they're missing from the film a little bit is they don't really interview like anyone from the record label, mm-hmm. or like people who maybe were doing their marketing or anything like that. Yeah. Because I guess I don't know if any of those people are still around. I would imagine there's still some people around.
Well, what is Danny Field's relationship to them?
Well, he was really just friends with them.
Okay. He wasn't like
their employ. He was the manager of the Ramones, and he mm-hmm. was also the guy who signed the Stooges and the MC5 mm-hmm. on the same day, I think, or on the same trip to Detroit. Mm-hmm. He signed both bands, but he did not have an actual... As far as I remember, I don't think he had a working relationship with the Velvet Underground. Mm-hmm. He's known as like the creator of punk because of the Stooges MC5 thing.
And Ramones.
And then he also is the longtime manager of the Ramones.
Right.
And there's a famous story where he played a cassette. I think it was a cassette. No, maybe not. I don't know. He played a recording of the Ramones early on for Lou Reed. And Lou Reed said, this is fantastic. This is the best thing. This is the best band I've ever heard, or something like that.
Okay.
Or the best thing you've ever played me, Danny. Because like they were friends back from early days. Anyway.
I was just expecting all the Lou Reed kind of like negativity vibe would come out.
Yeah, no, that's why it's a notable thing, because he didn't like a lot of stuff.
I've heard a story, which may be, you know, it's a very third-hand story, but I think the story I'd heard is that, you know Quintron from New Orleans, had sold a drum buddy to Laurie Anderson.
Oh, wow.
And went to deliver it and like hung out with them.
Oh, wow.
This is like a very third hand story. I like to picture it being true, though. Yeah,
that's probably true. That's probably true.
She would love like buying a drum buddy. So as the film goes on, then there's like a, you know, people just start getting thrown off the train as it goes. First, you know, Nico leaves kind of like, it doesn't seem like a big, you know, crisis when Nico leaves. She just kind of seems like she's on her own trip. I think like Andy getting fired as a manager, I still don't quite understand what the thinking was here, other than maybe just ego, right?
I have a theory. Okay. After watching, I've watched this now like three times in preparation for this. So now I have a theory that's developed, which is basically that, you know, first of all, they go out on this tour, right? It's mm-hmm. the Exploding Plastic Inevitable tour, mm-hmm. whatever, the variety show. Andy's on the tour, and they're mainly playing in art museums.
Right, that Andy booked,
and then places like that. And then, and then usually everyone would come to just to see Andy Warhol in person. And then they would, and then the Velvet Underground would start playing. And then half the crowd or more would leave.
Right.
Because they were not the rock and roll crowd. They were the high art crowd.
Mm-hmm.
They were the high end, you know, art crowd of whatever city they're in. So,
sure.
So the touring was not great. They did not, you know, they didn't have any songs on the radio at the time. Obviously, they didn't have a hit song or nothing. The radio was not playing the records. Then there's the whole story of them recording White Light, White Heat, which I was glad to know why that record kind of sounds like shit. There's a good explanation for that in this film. Do you remember that?
I know I don't. Scene? I remember them saying they're on speed. But that, the guy leaving the room, that's what it was, right?
The engineer was so disgusted with them and their weird sound that he said, I'll just turn on, I'll hit record, I'm going to walk out and take a smoke, and you guys can do whatever. Just tell someone come grab me when it's time to hit stop.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was how that record was recorded. And they basically everything just turned all the way up into the red. With no like control over it at all. Anyway, I love that record actually, just some of the songs on it. But I knew there had to be like a reason why it sounds it's recorded so poorly. And there is a good reason given in the film.
Yeah.
So they explain that. So the experience up to that point, those are the two records that have John Cale. Velvet Underground and Nico and White Light, White Heat. Those are the only two records that have John Cale. And then basically Lou Reed is unhappy. I think Lou Reed is unhappy because all this artsy-fartsy nonsense, the John Cale element, the Andy Warhol element, are getting in the way of his vision of being a real rock star. You know, he wants to be Mick Jagger. He wants to be David Bowie. He wants to be that level, and he's not getting there with these lizards.
This weird-ass band of art people. Even though, like
In his mind,
right? Because it's like, I feel like the art angle for pop music now, or maybe not all pop music, but I think, like, there is, like, it's like art's kind of cool, right? So it's like, but it is a different audience, right? Like, it's an audience that just wants to come to be looky-loos, essentially.
Yeah.
Which I've definitely seen that happen in other scenarios. I was thinking of, like, when there would be this one time in San Francisco, like, Matthew Barney had this huge show at the SF MoMA. Mm-hmm. And so him and Bjork were, like, DJing at this famous gay bar, The Stud. And then there's just an insane I went because my friends wanted to go. And it's just an insane line of people to just go watch these two famous people, like, DJ. And, like, Matthew Barney's playing, like, black metal or whatever. But, like, people are just I'm also part of this. Like, I want to see what Bjork is playing on her iPod or whatever. I think it's a funny crossover thing. I'm trying to think of people that have actually, like, been successful in both those things in, like, the modern era. You know, people that are
This also brings up another thing, which is I guess let's finish up that chapter of the film. So basically, after White Light, White Heat, Lou, after a gig or something, Lou takes Mo and Sterling out to a diner and says, you have to choose. You can either you can either go with John Cale and continue a band with him, or you can stay in the Velvet Underground with me. And he's the singer. So, you know, they kind of have no choice because without Lou, you don't have the Velvet Underground.
Right.
So,
right.
It's kind of interesting at that moment, they just basically say, I guess you've got us in a place where we can't really make an easy decision, but the only decision is really to stay with Lou and continue the Velvet Underground.
And he doesn't tell John at all. Like, John finds out from Sterling that he's like out of the band.
He finds out from Sterling that he's been kicked out of the band and then replaced by Doug Yule.
Mm-hmm.
And then they make the Velvet Underground self-titled record, which is a really good record.
Yeah, it's a good record.
And Classics. It has It does have some weird, like that, the murder mystery song. I always thought that was like John Cale weirdness, but clearly he wasn't on the record. So yeah. That was just Lou Reed being weird. He was definitely capable of being weird and artsy.
Yeah.
Still without John around. But anyway, so then they make that record and Loaded, and then they're done, right? Is that right?
Did they do a record without Lou? I don't think they do a record without Lou, no.
If there is, it's not mentioned in this film.
Yeah, makes sense.
I should know this, but I don't.
I feel like I should know it too. This has basically been like, I'm like, I hope I know a little bit about this band. I think I know about this band, but then after watching this, maybe I don't know as much as I thought I did.
I definitely felt that after watching this film that I didn't know as much as I thought I knew about all of them. So then you've got, at a certain time, I have it in the timestamp written down for Andy Warhol being fired.
I think
that he fires Andy Warhol in a moment of panic about his career, about his chances of becoming a rock star, and he's tired of being known as like the band that Andy Warhol champions, like the house band of the factory or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like he's just tired of like that being the only thing they're known for. And so basically I think they said something like Luke, I think it was a John Cale quote, or was it a Sterling quote? Talking, and he says Lou went kind of crazy.
Oh right.
And had this angry discussion with Andy behind closed doors and fired him as our manager without discussing it beforehand with any of us. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, well, at the first time I saw the film, I'm thinking you have to be crazy to fire Andy Warhol as your band manager. But I think the more I went back and rewatched that part, I starting to understand that Lou was just frustrated that they weren't really taken seriously by the music world. They weren't being played on the radio. Andy wasn't really a music guy. He didn't know how to manage a band, really. He knew how to get you cool points in the art world.
Right.
But, you know, he didn't know how to promote a band properly. He obviously didn't know how to promote a tour.
There was a note about like how he produced the record. He's like, he was breathing in the room. That was like a lovely quote.
He got production credit for the Velvet Underground and Nico, and he didn't actually really do anything.
Yeah. It was just being in his orbit, essentially.
Yeah, just being in the same room as him. And it does seem like the friendship between Lou and Andy continued later in life, even after he fired him, because there's a scene at the end of the film where they're kind of talking, and this is post Velvet Underground, and Lou is like, it looks like from Lou's haircut and stuff, this is maybe like Transformer era.
That's what I was thinking too, but then Andy looks like he's in very poor health, so I'm thinking it's one of these kind of like maybe deathbed hangout or something, like just like, do you hear from these guys?
Right.
It's kind of felt like that to me, but but then his nails were like painted and he had the short hair and he looked a bit young. He looked like a 70s era. Yeah. So
yeah,
it was kind of heartening to see that, like, you know, he did have these, you know, other, that they had these moments where they kind of like were able to get along after the fact. I feel like it's just one of those things where like just time passes and you're just like okay with people. Like what do we fight about? What was that about? You know?
Yeah.
It could be one of those things.
So back to the, you brought up a thing about what other bands have had like one foot in success and one foot in the avant-garde. And the only other band I could really think of is Sonic Youth, who are the obvious like, you know, carriers of the torch of the Velvet Underground. They're like New York cool. They all do side projects and they do noise and drone and they champion younger artists and they definitely know like what's going on in the underground. And, you know, I really think they modeled themselves after the Velvet Underground in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's totally, yeah, the New York angle of that also being very much the case. And, like, you know, like Jim O'Rourke is, like, in it. So he's kind of like you know.
He's their Tony Conrad.
Fifth wheel, like a Tony Conrad. Or then, like, so.
Plus, and, I personally didn't really find out about John Cage or Stockhausen or Lamont Young or stuff like that until I got into Sonic Youth in the in the early 90s. It was through listening to Sonic Youth that you find out about all these other things.
That's true. That's totally true. Yeah, they're a good gateway for a lot of stuff.
They're the gateway drug.
Yeah.
I mean, then they basically, you know, ushered in Nirvana and a lot of other younger bands, you know.
Yeah.
By
yeah.
taking them out on tour. And I mean, even like the Boredoms, they took the Boredoms, you know, they took the Boredoms on tour or, you know, whatever. They introduced a lot of people to a lot of weird stuff.
For sure. I definitely would say I'm in a camp of you know, our generation. Probably that's like a key way to find out about that stuff. And like the New York angle, I think, as well, like sort of like even just like, you know, my fantasy world of New York is very like the Velvet Underground, you know, television, like all, like all this stuff, you know, like it just like in my imagination, in Sonic Youth too, like just in my imagination of like what New York was going to be like is all this stuff for sure.
So it took a little while for that, for another band to kind of pick up the torch and run with it. But I think, you know, I mean, Sonic Youth was playing in the, what, 1981, somewhere
around I think like right maybe 81, 82. Also, like, in a weird way, does that mean like the Swans is like the theater of eternal music, dream music or whatever? Like, weren't they all involved in like Rhys Chatham and Bronca and like the Swans? And like the Swans, I think everyone, like, I think Lee and Thurston all had some foot in that as well.
Yeah, definitely Glenn Bronca was like probably the instigator to you know, to them. He is to Sonic Youth what Lamont Young was to the Velvet Underground.
This is like a very specific kind of podcasty type of sentence that you will not hear anywhere else. Like, yes, Glenn Bronca is like the analogies of Glenn Bronca to Lamont Young. Also, like, Lamont Young and Tony Conrad famously did not get along, right? That was my understanding.
Oh, I don't know a lot of the politics of the insider avant-garde world of who didn't like who.
I think it's sort of this thing about, like, this is improvised music, but Lamont took credit for it, I think, is this, that's the story I was told. Anyway, like, it's good for, this is a good film for, like, nerding out on that stuff. And, like, Todd Haynes, he obviously based a character in a film on Lou Reed, so like this is like makes sense. This is like kind of like his scene. Stylistically, it's got a lot of cool like split screen and like kind of does a little bit of like, in the beginning I was like, are they doing the kind of thing that everyone does, like there's like the Kennedy assassination, like every film like just has to time code itself, but like 9/11, the Kennedy like, you know, something like that. But then they're just like, oh, here's like Harry Smith animations. He was like Nam June Paik, like really focusing on like the art world aspect of it. I appreciate that.
Yeah. They don't really timestamp it to political events, really.
Generally, I don't think so. Like, it was just that only in the very setup. And then I realized the second time watching it, because there was some stuff, oh, this intro, they're showing Nico in like some German commercial or something also, and they're showing everyone kind of early on. Would you recommend this to someone who has no concept of the Velvet Underground, or do you think it would just be like a little too insider for someone who's like, not like your kids? Would you show your kids this?
Anytime my kids walked into the room a couple of times while I was watching it, and it was all like weird artsy Warhol footage on the screen, and they were like, what the what are you watching, you know, like,
you're like, I have a podcast to do.
I'm like, I'm doing research, just leave me alone. I think it might be a little too deep into I don't know, into the avant-garde world, especially for the first like 45 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think it kind of like picks up speed. And I think also like Jonathan Richman is so charming in it. And like he kind of steals the show. A lot of people said that on Twitter, I think, yeah. You know. So I do think that there's something to be gained from it if you have no familiarity with the band. I do still think it's a great piece of art.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, there's definitely Andy Warhol is fascinating to me on many levels. Just the whole mystique about him and like how he basically ran New York.
And, yeah.
You know, like, it's fascinating. So like, if you want to know more about Andy Warhol, this, it's like I said, it's almost as much of a Warhol doc as it is a Velvet Underground doc.
Yeah. I felt that as well. Dan, we play a game on this show where we cast a doc.
Gotta cast this doc. Gotta cast this doc.
And yes. Like you said, you already worked on the Nico biopic, which I believe is a German actor plays Nico in that. Is that right?
Danish
actor. Yeah. Okay.
But here's the thing. I was thinking about this. So I came up with my casting.
Yeah.
And first of all, if Todd Haynes is listening to this or if Laurie Anderson is listening to this, you have to give me credit because this casting is perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually cast it in a very serious, like thoughtful way. Like who would you cast to play the young version of all of these characters?
Mm-hmm,
right. Mm-hmm. So here's what I came up with. And also, so I did not choose the same actress who played Nico in Nico 1988, because that's sort of the older Nico. Mm-hmm. So for Nico, I picked Ruth Radelet, who is the singer of Chromatics, who just broke up, because she looks almost exactly like Nico.
Yeah, I've seen her billboards.
Yeah, she looked, and she has the same haircut. I mean, she's almost styled herself to look like Nico. I don't know how her acting chops are, but I'm sure she could pull it off.
Yeah.
For John Cale, I have Adam Driver.
Yeah, that's interesting. I see sort because of like the weird shape of the really high cheekbone, weird face.
The facial shape is there. I think the large Adam's apple is there.
Yeah.
A lot of, and also Adam Driver just seems like he can do anything.
Yeah. I can see that.
Another person who seems like he can do anything, Rami Malek, I have as Lou Reed.
Yeah. That's a good one. He's very deadpan, but that, like, I could see.
That's how Lou that is.
Yeah. Yeah. He's very deadpan. That's true.
Yeah. I mean, and also in a lot of ways, the way that he played Freddie Mercury was kind of similar to how I could see him playing Lou Reed without the mustache.
Yeah.
Though I picked a kind of obscure person to play Sterling Morrison, this guy, Craig Roberts, who was the star of this movie called Submarine. Do you remember that movie?
Submarine, the British, is it British film?
Yeah.
Is it, was that directed by... What's his name? Craig what?
Craig Roberts.
Roberts. I'm just going to do a quick Google on this guy. Yeah, I think I want to say that was like directed by the guy from IT Crowd maybe. Oh yeah, I could sort of see that. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Also for Doug Yule, I picked Jason Schwartzman, although he's probably too old at this point to play
The way the game works, it can be kind of like anyone from any time in like, you know, they're like, you say young Seymour Hoffman or something if you wanted. Yeah.
Right. Then for Andy Warhol, this is a really good one. So I have Matthew McFadyen, who is Tom from Succession.
Is he like Welsh also in real life or something? I feel like he's Welsh.
I think that's right. Yeah.
A lot of,
No, but no, for Andy Warhol, not for John Cale.
Oh, as a Warhol. I could say, like Tom from Succession.
Yeah.
Perfect. I see, like,
Just imagine him with the Warhol wig on and the glasses.
Yeah.
And it's like good to go, right? And a little bit paler, maybe.
Yeah, definitely pale. Like Bowie plays Warhol in the Basquiat movie, right? Yeah.
That's my favorite performance as of anyone playing Warhol is actually Bowie playing Warhol in Basquiat.
I'm trying to remember, like, there is a movie, I Shot Andy Warhol, where it's Lily Taylor is in it. I don't remember who plays Warhol in that. Do you?
That person, I'd have to look it up, but that person did a pretty good job playing Warhol. I really liked that movie, and I saw it in the theater, I think, when it came out when I was in college. I should have rewatched that one in preparation for this, but I forgot.
There's so much. I should have watched every single. Yeah.
There's so many
things. Jared Harris played? Oh, my God. Jared Harris, who's like in every science fiction franchise now because he's in like the Expanse and stuff.
He did a great job as Warhol, I thought.
That's a funny
although
casting.
Not as good as Bowie.
Yeah,
Bowie as Warhol was really funny and looked he had the right look too. So okay, I have a couple more. I have Timothy Chalamet as Tony Conrad.
I could kind of like Tony Conrad, like he's not awkward, really a camera, like, but he's kind of got like a little bit of an attitude. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, Timothy Chalamet is just in everything now, so you have to put him in.
He would be. Yeah.
You have to throw him in.
Yeah.
Then I had for Lamont Young, I picked either John C. Reilly or David Cross.
Yeah.
Oh. They'd have to have like the full beard, you know?
Right, right.
Do you have any other names for that one?
I thought of a couple of people. This is very random, but I thought like maybe Eric Idle for Sterling Morrison. It was like looked at an older picture of Sterling Morrison. I'm like, oh, Eric Idle would be super interesting. And then I thought I was trying to think of someone for Jonathan Richman, and at a certain angle, I'm like Steve Coogan, and I think he could just do it. Like you know,
yeah. I didn't even go that far as to casting Jonathan Richman, but. Oh, so my last one is Mo Tucker, and I picked Vanessa Bayer from SNL.
Oh, yeah. She's her cherubic,
because she has that. Yeah, I felt like there were some photos of Mo in the mid-period where she kind of reminded me of Vanessa. And she has that innocent kind of like look to her, and I think that Vanessa could maybe pull that off. Anyway, that's my casting. Yeah.
Thanks. And Dan, would you want to plug the project that you're working on? In addition to being a publicist full time, you're also producing a podcast.
Yeah. So I just started producing a podcast called Discog Graffiti, about 10 episodes up now. Basically, I'm not on as a host. It's the two friends of mine, Dave and Joe, and they basically kind of do these listening trawls through artists' entire discography, and then they rate each release like 0 to 5 stars. And then at the end of the podcast, they give you like the top 3 picks for like the must own albums, and then the worst, and then their pick for like the worst album, like album to avoid, album you don't need to own from this artist. So like we started with like Pink Floyd and then went into like Cocteau Twins and did Beck, and then we did recently we had Spiral Stairs from Pavement on, and he did Roxy Music with the hosts. So basically from this point forward, we're trying to do more guests where we have the guest on and have the guest choose the artist that we're talking about, and then kind of all three combine their comments and their recommendations. So anyway, it should be interesting to see how that goes. We actually already have a really good interview recorded with John Landis.
Oh.
Where he talks about Paul McCartney, who he directed a video for.
How do you book John Landis on a podcast?
We booked, I don't know. Dave, one of the hosts, is friendly with him and just called him up, and I don't think he's ever even really done a podcast before, so.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, we're doing some interesting stuff there. We're going to cover, like, Bette Davis and the Raincoats, and there's a three-parter on the or two or three parter on the Bee Gees catalog coming up, which is another one which were like, I'm kind of like at a loss. There's so many Bee Gees albums. Which ones are great? Which I don't even really know from that early period when they were more like the Birds or something, the folkier era of the Bee Gees. I don't know really which records are the ones I need to own and not. So even for myself as a fan, I'm finding this podcast to be useful.
Yeah.
And I think it's also, it's aimed at, you know, either people who just have an artist missing from their knowledge base and they want to know what's, you know, where's a good place to start, or people who are just getting into record collecting for the first time and they want to just have three records by, you know, whatever, right, Van Halen or whatever, right, but not every single one.
I could have totally used this when I was learning about bands, because I remember people being like, you know what a good band, like Gang of Four, PIL, you know, the Mekons or whatever, and then I'd be like, I got a PIL record. It kind of sucks. But right, it's like an 80s PIL record. Oh,
you got
record.
The wrong one.
I got the wrong one. like, oh, yeah. Like, people are like, Gang of Four is amazing. I'm like, I don't know. I got this Gang of Four record. Like, oh, that's not the one to get. I'm like, oh, yeah, fuck. I
keep, you got a good entertainment.
Yeah, I know. I was off. When I got entertainment, I finally got it. But that's right, a great public service to all the new record buying public, the people that get a Crosley for your kid off to college, right, or something. So that's, I think Velvet Underground, that'd be a good one. You had four records to choose from Velvet Underground too. So
the only, I think that we've talked about doing Velvet Underground. The only reason we haven't done it so far is that all the albums would just be five stars.
Yeah. Yeah. All good.
Five stars, five stars, five stars, five stars.
Yeah.
They're all five star records. So there's nothing bad to say really, other than like I said, White Light, White Heat wasn't recorded in the greatest way, yeah, but it's still a five-star record because the songs are undeniable.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's the podcast, Discograffiti. There's discograffiti.com, and then it's Discograffiti on Twitter and Discograffiti Pod on Instagram.
Awesome.
Well, and then there's new episodes every Sunday night.
Man, that's a challenge to keep a schedule for podcast. So I'm told.
It is.
I'm told.
No, I know. Oh, another exciting thing is that we're going to do all of the solo albums of all four Beatles.
Ooh. Yeah.
Which is going to be like,
oh my gosh,
a seven part series or something.
Dude, we got, you know what? You've been a great guest, Dan. I want to have you back on the show sometime. We can talk. We can talk about some of your other favorite docs that came out. I saw a couple of them we've talked about on this show, like Some Kind of Heaven. We did a little crossover episode with Fraughtcast talking about that.
Right.
And obviously Get Back, we're going to have to talk about, seems to tie in
at some point.
Thing. Yeah. So yeah, Dan, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking to us about Todd Haynes's Velvet Underground.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com. Our theme music was written by David Siegel, and our executive producer is Will Scovel. Our associate producer is Nick Coltis, and our editor is Karen Hogg. Donate to the show through our Patreon page, patreon.com/supdocpodcast. If you want to help out in other ways, please share this show with a friend. Join the Doc Talk and check out our hot takes, pictures, and videos on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We're SupDoc Podcast on all those platforms. Don't forget to rate, review, and follow on Apple Podcasts. Find Paco and George's comedy gigs on the About Us page on our site. SupDoc is by Doc fans for Doc fans. So if you want to advertise, got a film, or opinions to share, hit us up. We'd love to hear from you and what you're docking out on. Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.